that went from my right to our left over our head. I stepped from behind my Humvee. I looked up front. My Marines were already discharging their weapons in towards the demonstrators. I unslung my weapon, put the weapon up into my shoulder. I aimed in. Fired at one, fired at another one, until we ceased fire. When everything was said and done, the smoke cleared, they laid four bodies. They were wearing traditional white jalaba, which was completely soaked red with blood. My lieutenant, a man by the name of Kevin Shea, decided he wanted to go on a reconnaissance of the area. I understood what he was talking about. He wanted to go on a reconnaissance to make sure that what we had done was a legal kill. My Marines were excited because my Marines had finally been blooded. See, you're not a Marine until you kill. Not a Marine until you get that first taste of blood. So I remember as we're driving by the bodies, I'm looking. The bodies are almost stacked up on top of each other. It's like they huddled together to try to stop the bullets. And I'm looking at the bodies and I'm not seeing any weapons. And then it hit me. I got this panic attack and I thought to myself, my God, these were civilians. They were just holding a peaceful demonstration. And then I said, no. What are you doing, buddy boy? You're a Marine. These things happen. This is law of war. This is combat. This is Murphy's Law. See, but that conscience kept on eating. And it kept on eating. The next day, we went to the Baghdad Stadium. By this time, my lieutenant and I, we put our thinking caps together and we came up with a plan. What we were going to do is we were going to start an imaginary zone, a green zone and a red zone. And then we're going to place our sniper out, our 50 caliber sniper. When the car entered into the green zone, we gave a hand and arm signal, stop, stop. And then we gave it audio. We fired our weapon up into the air, stop. By that time, my sniper had already placed a well-placed shot into the engine block of the vehicle, forcing the vehicle into the red. They're only 50 meters apart from the green and the red. Then we would unleash a wall of lead. Well, when we unleashed the lead and everything was said and done, the smoke cleared, we ran over to the car. We started pulling the bodies out. One thing that I can tell you that all of these civilian casualties had in common. There was no weapons in the vehicles. There was no terrorist propaganda or anything like that linking them to any type of terrorist or insurgency. So as we start pulling the bodies out and we're searching the car, three of the young men were expiring fast. We started providing medical treatment. The driver of the vehicle was miraculously unscathed. To this day, I don't know, God, Allah, Buddha, whoever, somebody was looking after this young man. This young man that was unscathed was upset because one of the members in the car was his brother. These young men weren't wearing turbans on their head. They weren't even dressed in traditional Iraqi clothes. They were dressed in Western clothes. Collared shirts, slacks, loafers, fresh haircuts, trim beard. Driver began going up and questioning my Marines. He was asking them, why did you kill my brother? We didn't do anything to you. We're not terrorists. We got the three Iraqis back to the medical area. Meanwhile, the driver, he's going up to my Marines and he's talking to him and he's asking him, why did you do this? Why did you kill my brother? Why did you do this? Where's he at? Finally, about 20 minutes later, the corpsmen come back with the bodies, corpsmen's medical personnel, and they dump the bodies on the side of the road from the stretchers. I go running over and I ask the corpsman, what the blank are you doing? They said, Staff Sergeant, medical officer said bring him back. There ain't nothing we can do for him. What do you mean there ain't nothing you can do for him? I don't know, Staff Sergeant, that's just what they said. So you gonna leave him here? They just walked off. The driver was sitting there holding his brother's head in his arms, and he's rocking back and forth, and he's crying and he's weeping. He came up to me shortly after that, and he got right up in my face. He got eyeball with me, the most hatred look I've ever seen on a person's face. He said, why did you kill my brother? We didn't do anything to you. We're not terrorists. I'll be honest with you. I lost it. I went a little mad. I began to express my indifference to what was going on vocally. Everything came to a head on the outskirts of Karbala when my lieutenant came up to me. It was after a battle plan meeting. And he said, Staff Sergeant, what's wrong? You're looking a little under the weather. Your performance has been sliding. You're agitated all the time. Him and I, we got into a little heated discussion back and forth about what was going on. Finally, he stopped and he looked at me and he said, Staff Sergeant, I want you to explain to me. You tell me, how do you feel about Iraq? What's going on in your brain housing group? I looked at him, I said, you want my honest opinion, sir? I'll tell you how I feel about Iraq. I said, I think that we're committing genocide and that we're leaving enough depleted uranium to ensure continued genocide. He stopped, kind of took a step back, shook his head a little bit, and he just walked off. Shortly after that, I was ordered to report into the division psychiatrist. Psychiatrist asked me what was wrong. I explained to him. He said, we killed a lot of innocent civilians. Told him all about the different scenarios, how it happened, when, where. At the end of the session, he looked at me and he handed me a 100 bottle count of Zoloft and some Ambien to help me sleep. And I said, well, what else? He said, I'm going to recommend that you be medevaced immediately out of Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression. When I got back stateside, I was ordered to report into the mental health clinic. I reported into the mental health clinic to a lady by the name of Beverly Dexter. I sat there for an hour. Told her everything about the casualties, went into great detail. She stopped, she looked at her watch, and she said, time's up. She said, Staff Sergeant, I can't help you. I said, what do you mean you can't help me? I don't deal with conscientious objectors. She said, you're gonna go have to talk to the chaplain. I looked at her and I said, you label me as a conscientious objector because I don't want to kill innocent civilians? Lady, I just came back from hell. I killed for you. I killed for my country. I did what I was told. And you call me a conscientious objector? Shortly after that, I hired an attorney, a man by the name of Mr. Gary Myers, out of Washington, D.C. Mr. Myers was a representative at the May Lie trials. And after I explained to him everything that had happened, he said that he was going to talk to the Marine Corps and that he wanted me present on the phone while he was talking to him. He was going to talk to the Navy. Well, he talked to him, and it was pretty amazing because the Marine Corps changed from not to day after that conversation. I remember the regimental sergeant major saying, Staff Sergeant, I think we understand completely what it is. Well, what's wrong with you? So what we're going to do is we're going to discharge you medically, PTSD, and major depression. Thank you. Have a nice life. I was medically discharged December 31st, 2003, honorably. I made a promise to the Marine Corps. I made a promise that when I was discharged, that I would tell everybody about what I had witnessed and what I had done. And I'm keeping my promise. Thank you.
You're listening to former Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey speaking last Friday in Ithaca. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville in North Carolina. We continue as Jimmy answered questions from the audience, many of them parents of the students he'd spoken to earlier in the day at Ithaca High.
Yes, I got a neighbor that's a Marine, and all I see, and I know people from the Vietnam War, the Army and the Marines are trained to hate. They're trained to kill, because they go in as wimps and they come out like they're big thugs and they want to beat on the people that's been pushing them around out here. So they come out and they get arrested and get in all kinds of trouble after they get discharged, but they're trained to kill and that. You're brainwashed.
Thank you, thank you. Yes, sir, in the back. Yes, sir. The question was, is there any Marines that I know of that feel the same way that I do? And are there any organizations that are trying to disseminate this or get this word out? Is CNN here tonight? No, they were supposed to be here, seriously. I talked to them on Tuesday on the phone. That was the fourth interview that I'd done with CNN. The fourth one. They never cover it. They're not going to cover it. They don't want this information out. As far as any other Marines feeling the way that I do, there were members of my platoon that actually came to me and said, hey, Staff Sergeant, I've got a big problem with what's going on. But my response was, hey, devil dog, suck it up. We're not here to play politics. We're not here to play patty cake. We're here to do what the President of the United States wants us to do. See, because if I would have said anything else, I would have been tried as a mutineer, which is punishable by death. So you can't disrupt the even flow of the Marine Corps. I was over at the high school earlier this morning, and I tell you what, it was good. They were attentive and listened to everything that I said. I didn't hold back. Actually, some of the administrators came came in and said, hey, this guy, he's a little radical. they started getting nervous. But I didn't hold anything back. I told him exactly. I told him how the recruiters operate. One other thing I'd like to say real fast. You know, I've been giving y'all a lot of negative. All right, so now it's time to give y'all some positive. You're probably thinking to yourself, how can we change this? How can we stop this from happening, the recruiting process? It's easy. You got the power. It's all right here in this room. See, all you got to do is go down to the recruiting office and you talk to the Army, then you talk to the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines, and you tell them that you want them to come down to the school because you are concerned, you are a concerned parent, a concerned citizen, and other ones, and you can actually get a petition together and have everybody sign it and say, we want you to come and give us a presentation and show us how you are recruiting the young people in the high schools. And they have to do it. You pay their salaries. The recruiters work for you. You don't work for the recruiters. It's an easy process. That's how you do it. That's how you fix it. They have to do it. If they don't do it, then you can give me a call, and I'll make it happen.
Wouldn't they just lie if they
came
in?
Oh, sure, they're
going to
lie to you. They're going to lie. The question is, will they lie to us, or will they lie to you? Sure, they're going to lie to you. That's their bread and butter. What you're going to do is you're going to attack them, and they're not going to like it. They're going to do everything that they can to try to counteract that, because you're taking away their meal ticket. But if you've got veterans in the group that can ask the poignant questions, you can catch them in the lie. It's easy. All you got to do is just have a well-planned function. A well-planned function. Get the questions in order that you want to ask before the event and go with it. It's simple. The worst fear that I had on recruiting was when I got kicked out of Murphy High School, Tim Queen's old high school. The school board kicked me out. The parents banded together and said, get this guy out of here, and it worked. The Marine Corps, a lieutenant colonel flew in from Washington, D.C. in little old Murphy, North Carolina, population 10,000, and took care of business. He went into the high school and said, we're sorry, the recruiter has been reprimanded. We know that he did this. Can we please get back in your high school? And after about 2 weeks, they finally gave in and they said, yeah, we'll let him back in. 2 weeks. This is a battle, folks. There was one. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You touched on it a little bit earlier about the use of EU weapons.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Question was about the depleted uranium. I didn't know about depleted uranium until I read an article in a Rolling Stones magazine when I was on recruiting duty. I didn't have a clue about depleted uranium. So I'm sitting there. I've always had a subscription to Rolling Stones. So I'm sitting there, and I'm reading this article. By the time I get done with it, I'm thinking, that's hippie trash. that's those wacko hippies making some stuff up. But then I started inquiring. I started asking other Marines, do you know about this depleted uranium? Yeah, it's on the tanks. That's what the tankers fire. Well, do they have machine gun ammunition with depleted uranium? Why are you asking so many questions? I just want to know. Now, here we are, 2 weeks, well, it was actually about a week and a half before we invade Iraq. No depleted uranium rounds. I'm sitting there thinking, this is a sham. This is just the hippies talking. You know, this depleted uranium stuff ain't true. Week and a half before we invade Iraq, we go down to the ammunition supply point and we draw out our combat ammunition supply. And lo and behold, there they are. My Marines, they go over there and they break open the box. They start pulling them out, looking at them. And I went up to the ammo tech and I said, "Is that a depleted uranium round?" And he looked at me, shocked, and he said, "Yes." Yes, yes.
I have a question, well, related to my brother, just turned 18 years old, and he's been wanting to do the Marines for years, and against, like, everyone in his family wants, he went and signed up. So, I guess I have two questions. At this point, is there any way that he could get out if he changed his mind? And the other question is, since he totally bought everything that the recruiter had to say, like, what would you say to kind of counter that? Or, I mean, what would you say to a kid that already just bought what the recruiter had to say?
There was a young man that I talked to at the high school today. You can get out of the delayed entry program. This young man came up to me and he basically wanted me to tell him that it was okay with what he was doing. I mean, he was starting to break down right there in front of me. So it's a way you can get through to him. But what it's going to take is that shock. He's got to have somebody that reaches him and wakes him up. But you can't wake up everybody. Because I remember when I was that age, you can't wake up everybody. And unfortunately, a lot of guys, they're going to have to find out the hard way. And they'll wind up like me. Yeah. I'm 33 years old. I'm 80% disabled by the VA. I'm service-connected disability. My doctor put in the paperwork to up it to 100% disabled. Not by my choice. He felt that my PTSD is so traumatizing that I'll never recover from it. I take 4 different types of antidepressants and 1 antipsychotic every day. I've been diagnosed with degenerative spinal disease. I don't know if it's from the depleted uranium or not, but it's funny. I come back from Iraq and I've got a constant dull pain in my lower back all the time. And I go to the doctor and they tell me I've got degenerative spinal disease and I'm 33 years old. What is that?
Now, my concern is, just as a point of clarification, is that if there is a draft, it's not like you can just say, "Oh, I used some drugs, therefore you can't draft me," right? I mean, I don't want people to think it's easy to stay out of, like, it's a different thing to be recruited than it is to be drafted. And I think the standards are real different, right?
I could tell you right now how to get out of the draft. All you got to do is have your child go down and get a medication for Zoloft. Just get a subscription or prescription. He doesn't even have to take it. Just get a prescription for Zoloft. He's done. He's done. He'll never go into the military. Yes, ma'am.
Which is, why are all these people in the military willing to not think for themselves and just obey?
Why are the people in the military not willing to think for themselves but just obey? It's an esprit de corps. The Marine Corps teaches you to have that esprit de corps. See, when I was in combat, or so-called combat, ladies and gentlemen, I only got shot at one time, and it lasted for 5 seconds. The media did this big frenzy, and whenever we would be firing into these towns, because we didn't have any Geneva Convention, we could fire anywheres. The reporters would run up to us, and they'd be like, "We're with 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, and they're taking incoming fire." We're not taking incoming fire. We're just shooting at the city. That's what happened. But why? Why are these Marines so eager to follow these orders? Because of esprit de corps. You're there to protect your buddy. You're not there to play a politician or anything like that. The training that Marines go through desensitizes them to violence, dehumanizes them.
Brainwash.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Jimmy, what does the phrase "support our troops" come to mean to you? What do you think its social function is?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, the guy that ever invented that, I guess he's sitting on $1 million right now. The veterans, I'm a member of the Veterans for Peace and also the Iraqi Veterans Against the War. I'm a co-founder of the IBAW. But we're starting a new campaign in Asheville, North Carolina with the Veterans for Peace. We're calling it Save Our Soldiers. Save Our Soldiers. Save them from themselves. Save them from the make sure that they still have their humanity intact. Start teaching them that the humanity of what they're about to undergo through, don't let them sell their soul. This is the education that we have to give them. We have to give them an education on humanity. This is something that the schools don't teach. They don't talk about the genocide with the Native Americans. They don't talk about that. They don't talk about the African Americans being exploited in the South on plantations. Or they do, but they don't go into a lot in depth about it. Not to the point that it should. Yes, ma'am.
This is my daughter, and I'm the mother of the boy she's talking about in the high school, who just signed up, just turned 18. He had promised he was going to wait, but he didn't. So he surprised us by just announcing that he signed up last week. Now, did he see you today? Did
yes.
Everyone have to?
Does he have two earrings?
No, he's very tall and blonde, and he looks like a Marine.
Yes, I did. There was two young men. One of them had two earrings, and the other one was tall, and they went into the Marine Corps. He didn't talk to me.
In the deferred program. He's going in October, supposedly. He promised us he was going to wait till after the summer because he's got plans for the summer. But we're just all upset and in shock about the fact that he did it.
I talked to him today. The presentation. But he didn't come up to me afterwards. His buddy did, though. His buddy looked like he was seriously having some second thoughts. So.
My son heard you today.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
As far as getting out of that program, though.
Getting out of the program?
Because the recruiters make it seem to that these guys that you sign this paper and there's no going out.
You have to write a letter.
That's all you
do. Just look in the bed.
There's lots of literature about that back here on the table, including sample letters for how to get out.
Yes, sir.
Whatever has become of your youthful dream of becoming an automotive engineer?
I guess God didn't want me to be an automotive engineer. He said that being a peace activist was more important.
Jimmy Massey, soldier turned activist, speaking last Friday in Ithaca. Now for some announcements of local anti-war activities next week. There will be three in Ithaca. The first is a day-long vigil-a-thon from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the intersection of Route 13 and Clinton Street in front of CVS. The theme is Another World is Possible. Show up at any time and stay as long as you like. For more information, contact Katie Quinn Jacobs at kqj@quinn-jacobs.org. Please do not park in the CVS parking lot. There will be a march through downtown Ithaca. Participants should meet at noon at Washington Park. That is between Court and Buffalo Streets at Park Place on Ithaca's north side. That's noon. The walk will proceed past the vigilathon and end at the Commons. Bring signs, instruments, costumes that express whatever you'd like to communicate. For more information, contact Linda Holzbauer at ljholzbauer@yahoo.com. That's spelled LJHOLZBAUR@yahoo.com. There will be a presentation in the afternoon, The Human Costs of War, What's Next After 2 Years of U.S. Occupation, by Morris Stevens and George Sapio, from 3 to 5 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church of Ithaca, at the corner of Cayuga and Court Streets. Enter on Court Street. Donations will benefit the Education for Peace in Iraq Center EPIC. For more information, contact Jim Semp at 227-4727, 227-4727 in the 607 area code, to volunteer at the event or donate baked goods or drinks for refreshments. And there will be a peace march on March 19th in Trumansburg. Marchers should meet at 10 a.m. at the TCAT bus stop in front of Teberg Schools on Main Street. Park on Main Street. People are encouraged to make signs with their own messages, but there will also be some available. They'll march through town down Main Street, then gather in a circle for silence to honor those dead or wounded in the Iraq War, and then there will be a time to speak out. All this information will be posted on our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Click on the audio archive. And all those events again are occurring on Saturday, March 19th, as part of a National Day of Action to end the occupation of Iraq. Also last Friday, 4 Ithaca-area war resistors were arraigned in federal court in Binghamton. Peter DeMott, Claire Grady, Danny Burns, and Teresa Grady have already been tried in Tompkins County for their acts of nonviolent civil disobedience at the Military Recruiting Center at Pyramid Mall on March 17, 2003. The trial resulted in a deadlocked jury, 9-3 in favor of acquittal. Unable to get a conviction here, the Tompkins County DA, George Dentes, asked the federal court to try the 4, citing it where no Tompkins County residents will be part of the jury pool. The 4 were given a 4-page indictment which named just about every anti-war demonstration they have been a part of as indication of a vast conspiracy to intimidate the U.S. government, and they could, if convicted, face 6 years in prison. The 4 pleaded not guilty. As a condition of bail, they were prohibited by the judge from engaging in any so-called crimes from now until their trials, which the activist said was an obvious attempt to bar them from acts of war resistance on the upcoming National Day of Action. The 4 are part of the Pledge of Resistance campaign, a national faith-based initiative of people committed to acts of civil disobedience to end the war. Their trial will take place this spring or summer, and we'll bring you more on this story in future programs. About 20 supporters made the 60-mile trip in the snow to show solidarity to these courageous and much-loved members of our community, and your ongoing support will be essential as they face these serious charges. We'll conclude this week with one of the most eloquent voices of those radicalized by their military service, Stan Goff, no stranger to regular listeners here. He spoke to a meeting of military families in New York City last December.
Stan Goff began his military career in Vietnam as a grunt with the 173rd Airborne Brigade. He went to Guatemala, El Salvador, Grenada, Panama, Venezuela, Honduras, South Korea, Colombia, Peru, Somalia, with special operations units before participating in the 1994 invasion of Haiti. So obviously, this man knows a lot about the United States military and what it's doing in all parts of the world. He worked in infantry, ranger, special forces, and counter-terrorist units, as well as taught at the Jungle Operations Training Center at West Point. Today, Stan is a writer in Raleigh, North Carolina, and a granddad, so we're homeboys. 2 of his children have joined the military, and 1 has been to Iraq. He is a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Veterans for Peace, and Military Families Speak Out. He says he has watermelon politics, green, red, and pink with seeds that are black. There are elements of socialism, ecology, feminism, and revolutionary black nationalism in his writing. And this is a quote from Stan. There is a seamless connection between 2 million mostly brown prisoners in the U.S., Abu Ghraib, and Fallujah. Rape culture, political acclimation, and the destruction of our biosphere. When we learn that, we will quit asking the powerful to give us these things and that thing, and we will force them to surrender their power. Ladies and gentlemen, stand off.
All those things you talked about, granddad's my favorite one of those. And my grandson's second birthday is on Friday, this coming Friday. And I don't see my grandson wearing body armor. And I don't want to see them sent to kill somebody that looks just like that in another country. I want to thank the organizers of this very important defibrillation of the anti-war and anti-empire work that was put on hold by the recent elections. I want to thank my fellow speakers and presenters, and I want to thank everyone who's here for your tireless and stubborn refusal to confuse setbacks with defeats. I tend to think of resistance politics these days as if they were a Charles Dickens novels, and anybody who knows Charles Dickens knows that there's always a happy ending in the last chapter, but every chapter leading up to the last chapter is sad. And I'm extremely honored to be here today with Christian Parenti, whose book, Lockdown America, I consider canonical in many ways and which should be required reading prior to entrance into any university. I quoted Mr. Parenti extensively in a long analytical piece I did from the wilderness that attempts to show how utterly connected the incarceration industry in the United States is with the entire system of late imperialism, and in particular, why these most direct and brutal forms of social control, including prison rape and sexual humiliation, which are secretly sanctioned by the state, draw a straight line from a place like Pelican Bay maximum security lockup to Abu Ghraib in Baghdad. There's another book that I want to recommend, and it's not about Kabul or Baghdad, but about Southern California. It's written by radical urban theorist Mike Davis, and it's entitled Ecology of Fear. And in it, Davis describes, among many other things, how the development of high-end residential housing enclaves in the suburban foothills of LA spread into the habitats of mountain lions. Now, from time to time, explains Davis, a mountain lion, described as a rogue, of course, eats Fluffy the Cocker Spaniel or encounters and attacks one of the yuppie joggers, demonstrating how the feline diet can be diversified to include spandex. And this is interesting to me because these encounters are referred to by the press and by the members of those communities as a mountain lion problem. Now, obviously, the mountain lions are not getting equal time on the nightly news at these young Republican settlements, or the mountain lions might explain that they were there first, and from where they stand, they have a people problem. But the mountain lions don't have equal time. And this phrase, mountain lion problem, this phrase and this concept stick because it's repeated over and over again until it is incorporated effortlessly into casual conversation and folded into descriptive lists until it becomes a single signifier. There's no longer a problem between people and mountain lions. The mountain lions are the problem. This is how the standpoint of selfish, clueless yuppies is enshrined as an axiomatic premise that is out of reach of any critique, because we simply breathe that premise like the air, and like the air, we take it for granted. This is one reason why we are important to the movement, not just against the war, but the movement to overthrow a system that breeds war. This is why veterans and military families and dissident soldiers are so important in this crucial period, because in this period, when the old tricks no longer work, and the depredations of this global system have once again consumed the very material bases of that system, its subordinated people and its wrecked environment, the essence of that system, its true essence, the gun and the bomb and the rape and the prison, are being unmasked by the necessity to use these colonizers' tools openly to preserve the colonizers' power. George Bush did not start this war. This war was waiting at the end of a road that we stepped onto decades ago. And by continuing to walk down that road, we have inevitably encountered what is at its end. How many Iraqis did Bill Clinton kill? Why did we not want to hear during this last electoral folly that the anti-Bush candidate selected for us by Wall Street and the Democratic Leadership Council did not promise to end the war, but to expand it? The communities of the military are in a unique position. They have a special standpoint to say we were there. We were not on CNN. We were not in the New York Times. We were there when you rained dioxin on us 35 years ago as you killed 2-3 million Southeast Asians. We were there in our family hothouses as the families when we carried the dioxin and the death back into our living rooms, in our relationships, into our children who were the hostages of our pathologies. We weren't in the swimming pool communities in the LA foothills. We're the mountain lions, and now you have a veteran problem. And now you have a military family problem. And now you have an I'm awake and I'm pissed off soldier problem. Only we're not mountain lions, and we're not consigned by our own natural limitations to helplessly watch our own destruction by this system. We were there. We are there. We have a special capacity and a special pedagogical responsibility to stop others from taking the air for granted, because that air is contaminated. It's poisoned by the criminality at the very genetic core of this whole system that needs Agent Orange and depleted uranium to enforce its will on those it would dominate and those who refuse to surrender their own humanity to this criminality. Who we call statesmen are often as not thieves. Who we call statesmen are often as not vandals. And who we call statesmen are often as not mass murderers. And who better to out them for what they are than those of us who have been held closest to their criminal hearts in their time of need? Our demands have a special force, and so we have, in these military communities, a special responsibility. The movement demanded that we not invade Afghanistan to kill 4,000 civilians as vengeance for the 2,800 killed on September 11th. The movement demanded that we not invade Iraq, where our government's already overseen the destruction of over 1 million human beings, half of them not having reached the age of majority, and Iraq has never been any kind of threat to the people of the United States, ever. Veterans for Peace and military families speak out, held out in the face of faint-hearted anti-Bush resistance, and never listened to the siren call of compromise and chauvinism that led many of our allies to tell us to drop the word now from our campaign to bring them home now. We were clear about the system, and we knew that the vandal that destroys your home is not the right person to decide who and how it will get rebuilt. We stuck to our demand, and time is proving us grimly correct. We were correct to demand that this criminal class cease and desist. And now the elections that put a mask of legitimacy on this system are passed, and we have to reiterate that demand. Now, we all know that demands are the glue that hold movements together, whether or not the powerful meet them. One of our pedagogical tasks in the next period, I think, is to educate the public about the difference between a demand and an assertive request. I already have my post-election bumper stickers, you know, impeach Bush, and I know that these little provocations, because that bumper sticker is intended to be provocative, are useful mostly to further polarize our society, which I think is a good thing, because as long as we stay polite with one another, we never seem to get to the point. And impeach sounds good, and I'm going to leave the bumper sticker on there, but a Congress of the criminal class is not going to impeach a fellow criminal unless a scandal is so out of control that it threatens the whole structure. Now, one thing I agree with Christian Parenti on is that I oppose the criminal justice system as it is, but I think we'll need prisons for a long time. And I say that because while my bumper sticker says impeach, what I really want to see for these people who are presiding over yet another generation of our kids being sent abroad to do their criminal wet work, what I really want to see is George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin and Condoleezza, I forgot who I am, Paul Wolfowitz, all the cabinet members, old and new, I want to see them slammed up against the wall, searched as roughly as an Iraqi detainee, put in handcuffs, and their sorry asses thrown into a cell in Guantanamo Bay. Now first we'll give Guantanamo back to Cuba where it belongs. Our job is not to be conciliatory. We are not diplomats. Our job is not to comfort the comfortable by reinforcing their denial. Our job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And that's our job because we were there. We know what these people have sent our children to do. We know what these people have sent our children to become. And I'm not whining about that. I'm not going to cry about what was done to me, you know, because the upside to it is that I'm grateful to the dominant class for my military career. I'm grateful to them. I'm grateful for my education. I'm grateful to be a soldier. I'm just not their soldier anymore. On my 19th birthday, I left McCord Air Force Base up in Washington to begin my international studies program in northern Ben Dinh province. My professors were a black buck sergeant named Eves, a professional con man named Westmoreland, and the courageous and patriotic soldiers of the NLF and NVA who taught me what it looks like to say no. I learned that a person can put one foot in front of another for a very long time. I learned that clouds and mosquitoes and thirst and sleeping in the mud won't kill you. I learned to accept my own mortality. I learned that what most of suburban America thinks is extreme and exceptional hardship is the daily reality of most of the world, and I began the process of learning that the comfort of those suburbs comes at a price, often paid by those we never see and whose hardship we can never comprehend. Now, what the Bushes and Rumsfelds have failed to understand about soldiers and now new soldiers and the families of soldiers who learn these things from us and with us is that when we learn that there are different experiences in the world, and when we learn to keep putting one foot in front of the other, and when we learn that we can survive extreme hardship, and when we learn to accept our own mortality, and when we learn to recognize con men, and when and if we finally learn that everything they say is a lie and every mission is vandalism and murder, then what is left behind is still a soldier, but he or she is not their soldier anymore. Those troops are our armed forces, and we have to reclaim them no matter the cost. Movements start with those who are not afraid. And they grow with those who are only a little afraid. The veteran just back from Iraq and the veterans of past conflicts who have snatched their humanity back from the system are not going to fall for every bullshit story. We're not going to fall for their appeals to criminality cloaked in patriotism. We're not going to be intimidated by the with us or with the terrorist rhetoric. And I hope they're listening. I hope you're listening, George and Don and all the rest of you. I expect you are. You know, George and Dick and Don. You're not going to shut these veterans up and these families, and you're not going to shut these soldiers up by shaking your little Patriot Act in our faces. Because some of us worked pretty hard and risked everything to fight for your lives. Don't you know that we'll fight harder for those children just like that back there? We'll fight harder against you now that we know the truth. See? They're turning us into soldiers and they don't know who they're screwing with anymore. These troops are our armed forces. They're not their armed forces. They're our armed forces. And we've got to reclaim them no matter the cost. Patriot Act. We're the ones who have the responsibility to teach the rest that patriotism of someone defending their home is not the same as the patriotism deployed to take our children away from their home. The patriotism of the invader is not the same as the patriotism of the invaded. We can teach them that because we went then and we're going to witness now. They hate witnesses, don't they? They hate witnesses the way that all criminals hate witnesses. And I've got something to say to the soldiers and veterans who aren't with us yet and who are wandering around in the wilderness at post-combat shock. Witnessing will heal you. PTSD is not the outcome of violence. PTSD is a recognition that you've been betrayed and that you are helpless when it happens. Because you couldn't do it any better or because you didn't know any better. You were helpless when it happened. Does anyone here know what the most common cause of PTSD in the United States is? Rape. Rape. Rape victims report that confronting their attackers, and not just in the court where the system tries to rape them again, but confronting one's attacker with a support group and outing the attacker are highly therapeutic. It's a way to recapture that lost agency from a former state of helplessness and standing back up in the world. For combat veterans, we have a group right here for you, and we will stand beside you when you out the authors of the crime by describing what it really looked like. We know that some of you claim to denial, that some of you are broken in body and spirit, that some of you rage, and that some of you turn your anger in on yourselves and crawl into a needle or a bottle or the chamber of a pistol. But there's a way out of that wilderness, and the path out is the path of the witness. Imperialism has staked a claim on our children in uniform, and that's why we will never relinquish our claim on them. We will never surrender in the struggle for the souls of this and future generations. Never. Those troops are our armed forces. They're not their armed forces. And we have to reclaim them no matter the cost. I said I was a grandfather, didn't I? Those of you who are grandparents know what I mean when I say, Dick Cheney, don't put yourself between me and my grandbaby. And expect me to retreat. You know? We're not going anywhere. In fact, we're not only not going anywhere, we're going to come after you. The veterans of this war, some of them still on active duty, are already organizing against it. Against the troops in Iraq write to us. The whistleblowers are emerging from within the service. The refusers are emerging from within the service. The MFSO family list is growing. The number of conscientious objectors is growing. The mutinies have already begun. We're going to court with stop lawsuits and defend military refugees in Canada. And soldiers in theater are setting up blogs to bypass the sitcom censors. There's a Camilo Mejia or a Mike Hoffman or a Kelly Doherty in every squad in the military waiting for us to help them into the light. George Bush, we are going to fight you for every single last one of them. To those troops who aren't ready yet, we'll be there when you are. We don't go away. We put one foot in front of the other, and we're never going to stop. When you decide that it's time to see what's on the other side of all taboos, you'll find us there. The veterans will be there, and families will be there. Now, I made that Dantean journey that you're on right now for 2 decades, separated from the very people who wanted most to confirm my humanity, and it was the humanity that I thought that I'd abandoned along the road through 8 conflict areas as a servant of this Ivy League mafia. But when I made the leap, these veterans and these families, they were there to catch me, and they catch me now when I fall. This movement is your family, and that door to that home always remains open. And if we're not home, look for us in the street, because that's where we're headed now. One foot in front of the other until we get where we got to go, because those troops are our armed forces and we have to reclaim them no matter the cost. And those, I think it's important to say this, those troops in Iraq are not our enemies, and they have to reclaim their children no matter the cost. So those families in Iraq and these families here, we're reclaiming our children from the same criminal clique. So who is the enemy now? You know, that's where we're headed now. We're going to do it with a 3D system of organizing. We're going to delegitimize, we're going to disobey, and we're going to disrupt. We're going to delegitimate this war, and we're going to delegitimate this system. If that's not enough, we're going to disobey them. And if disobedience is not enough, we're going to disrupt the system. We slept in the mud. We did the dirty work. We brought the wars back into our homes to be the burdens of our families, and they made us soldiers, so now that's what we're going to do. We're going to act like soldiers. We're not afraid of poverty. We're not afraid of prison. We're not afraid of death, so now what are you going to do? Without our fear, they have no power. And in movements, those who are not afraid will show those who are a little afraid the way. And we're not making a request. We know the difference between an assertive request and a demand. We're making a demand. Bring them home now. Let the Iraqis be the architects of their own future. And it could be grim. If there's a civil war in Iraq, there's a civil war in Iraq. We had the bloodiest war in human history as a civil war right here in this country to settle accounts that had to be settled one way or another. If that's what's got to happen, that's what's got to happen. This is not wine. It's not improving with age. We need to get out of there. The Iraqis have 5,000 more years experience with civilization than we do. They can figure it out without us there. If you want a compromise, you go turn on Judge Judy. And if you want a retreat, go book a cabana in Hawaii. And if you want to surrender, you go to Appomattox and read the plaques, because we ain't going anywhere. Thank you.
Stan Goff, former career soldier, now author and fierce opponent of imperialism, speaking last December to military families in New York City. Thanks to Fred Wynn for that recording. And Stan Goff has now got a blog at www.stangoff.com. That's stangoff.com. And our website is unwelcomeguests.org, where we'll post a listing of the local activities and contacts to our other speakers. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.